Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome renowned astronomer Bob Berman to the studio to field all of your astronomy-related questions. He's an author. He's a world traveler. He's a general wise guy. His most recent book is The Sun's Heartbeat on Little Brown. It's always fun to have Bob here and to take your calls. The number to call, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 is the number to call. And you could also tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, or go to our Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/WAMC radio. Or, and if that weren't enough, you could also go to our website, WAMC.org, hit the Vox Pop page, and there's a spot to comment at the bottom of that. It's WAMC.org/Vox Pop. Bob Berman, how you doing?
Great. Great to be here, Ray. Thank you.
It's very nice to have you back again. Now, there was some news this week about dark matter. What gives?
Oh, yeah. It's by Dennis Overby, my old friend back from the Woodstock days. Used to live in Woodstock.
Okay.
Well, it's an idea that maybe dark matter, since we don't know what it is, could be caused by the collision between matter and antimatter, because there's more antimatter in our vicinity than we ever thought possible. We know there's antimatter fountains in the center of the Milky Way.
How do we know that?
Spray, because antimatter gives off a characteristic signature of 511,000 electron volts. And whenever we see that, we know that positrons, which are electrons with a positive charge, are meaning regular electrons, and that's the energy they release. So whenever we detect that, we know that's what's going on. And there's puzzling antimatter sprays coming from the center of the galaxy that really makes no sense. Well, if somehow these collisions are the genesis of dark matter, even though we don't know what dark matter is, maybe that could explain dark matter. So the whole thing ends with a big question mark. We still don't know.
So, in other words, dark matter then would be neutral matter, kind of in between antimatter and
Yeah, we think there's a lot of candidates. One of them are neutralinos, which sound like kind of Italian pasta.
Mm, delicious.
Yes, we'll have the neutralinos with the white sauce.
Try the antipasto with that.
And it sounds like antipasta, doesn't it?
A little antimatter. Bit. Yes. Oh, that's odd.
So who knows what this stuff is? There's six times more dark matter than matter in the universe. Makes up about a quarter of the universe. About 70% of the universe is dark energy. We don't know what that is either. But 30% is either the stuff we know, baryonic matter made of the 92 familiar elements, mostly hydrogen, helium, and all the other good stuff that makes up our bodies and our planet. But most of it is dark matter. What is it? Is it sort of analogous to neutrinos, which are real but pass through everything as if it were fog? Dark matter must pass through everything else without interfering with it. It doesn't give off any light. It doesn't reflect light, which is just another way of saying it has nothing to do with electrons, because to see light either generated or reflected, electrons have to be involved.
Okay.
So dark matter can't have anything to do with electrons, but it could be just another type of particle that doesn't fit anything we know so far.
So basically, we know almost nothing in the grand scheme of things. We don't know what gravity is. We don't know what dark matter is. We know sort of what antimatter is, right?
Oh, yeah. Antimatter is very, not only do we know, but we create it.
Yeah, well, that's
there are
right.
Antimatter
you mentioned
factories.
That previous show.
You know, anybody who's had a PET scan in a hospital, the P in PET scan is positron. So positrons are created and help make images of the body. So we know how to make antimatter. In fact, anytime you get annihilations, great amounts of energy, you should get an equal amount of matter and antimatter. So antimatter is well known.
Okay, fair enough. Let's go to the phones, 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. We'll kick it off with Bart in High Falls. You're on.
Good morning. Okay. This comes from Einstein. I read Walter Isaacson's biography, 1905. He does a special theory of relativity, and he comes up with a famous equation, E equals mc squared. So, you know, I ask myself, how did he figure this out? And it's pretty obvious that you get energy from matter, but I don't know how he quantified it with double the square, the light speed. Do you, and can you explain it to me?
Sure.
Okay.
First, we have to explain to people what it means. You know, most people associate Einstein's relativity theories with E equals MC squared, despite the most amazing thing about relativity being relativity, that the passage of time and the length of things are, and the mass of objects are relative to how fast you're moving and what kind of gravitational field you are, and two people will perceive these in different ways, and he showed how they translate into each other. That was a big thing about relativity. E equals MC squared is yet another, but it's the most famous. The E simply stands for energy, as you know, and it's expressed in ergs. Tiny unit of energy, an erg is the amount of force you need to accelerate a gram of material to a speed of a centimeter per second over the distance of a second. The M is mass, expressed in grams. And the C is, of course, the speed of light, but not in miles per second, as if that weren't big enough. That's 186,282, as if that weren't big enough, but in centimeters per second. Imagine how many little tiny centimeters, 2.5 to the inch, photon of light could zoom past in 1 second if it can go 186,000 miles in a second. So it's a huge number, and we're not even finished with that, because then you take that huge number and multiply it by itself. So what this is really telling you is that a little tiny bit of mass, the M, the grams that you want to convert to energy, gets multiplied by this enormous number to show you how much energy there is. And the bottom line is telling you that there's a huge amount of energy in a little bit of mass, or expressed a different way, nature's way of storing energy is mass. Even something that looks disgusting like a cigarette butt is really an enormous amount of energy being stored.
Yeah.
And that was Einstein's brilliance. And he could see that that was the case because of energy equivalence in matter that's being both created and destroyed. And it works both ways. It also makes sense in nuclear fusion. The sun giving off the heat it does, Arthur Eddington at about the same time, although he really pinned it down in 1920, told us exactly how the sun shines via nuclear fusion by converting bits of itself to energy. In the case of the sun, it loses 4 million tons of itself per second. And this is not an abstraction. It means that if you had a giant scale and weighed the sun actually weighs 4 million tons less every single second as it creates the energy, which in the case of the sun is equal to about 4 × 10³ ergs of energy. That's how much it produces, thanks to that conversion.
Uh-huh. All right, Bart, thank you very much for that call, and well played, Mr. Berman. Let's go to Patrick in Amherst. Patrick.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
So I wanted to ask, you know, admission up front, I'm a big science fiction fan, but I try to read nonfiction as well because I want to understand, you know, what's going on in these novels that I read. One of the things that I'm fascinated by is SETI and the Fermi's paradox and the search for intelligence outside of our own solar system. I know that that's mostly been done looking for radio signals, but I wanted to ask if there's any push to look for, you know, mega-scale physical objects, something that we could just go and look at and say, yeah, there's evidence that we're not alone.
Well, obviously, if we saw a markings on some object that indicated intelligent creation, you know, the spurious and totally faked face on Mars,
right,
which was never really a face, but was seen by the Viking spacecraft when they were there on Mars in 1976. If those really had been artificially created, no question about it, in the Cydonia region on the surface of Mars. What we have done is use the Arecibo radio telescope to send radio signals toward an actual object. And I know this isn't what you're saying. You're saying looking for signs of intelligence. Of course, if we saw some design, like let's say we found a hexagon, a giant hexagon on the North Pole of Saturn, we'd say, well, duh, that has to be created by an intelligent life form. This is sort of an inside joke because
there
is a giant hexagon on the North Pole of Saturn that's 60 miles high and rotates as if it were a solid object, even though the wind is blowing and should have destroyed it. But other than that, and without getting too fanciful that was artificially created, we sent radio signals in the 70s towards the globular cluster M13 because it's got 750,000 suns, maybe many or most of which have planets. And so sending them a signal by the giant radio telescope means that in just 25,000 years, which is how far away it is, 25,000 light years, they're going to receive, we're going to have 750,000 star systems, all of the planets, all simultaneously hearing us say, hey, hi, how are you doing?
Right.
And if anyone is there with the capability, in only 25,000 years later,
yeah,
we'll hear, hey, we're fine, we're cool, how are you? It may, you know, it's going to be a slow-paced conversation, but that's we're already doing that.
But as far as you know, nobody's out there looking for Dyson spheres or anything like that.
Well, we'd see, obviously, with all the telescopes and the exquisite resolution of Hubble, if something were seen that were clearly, you know, the work of an artificial intelligence, you would have known about it because unlike the people who were into paranoid conspiracies.
Would we know about it?
Yeah, there's nobody in the astronomical community who doesn't have a big blabbering mouth and wouldn't be telling all their friends, girlfriends, and everybody else. Right. You'd know about it right away.
All right, so no secrets. Hey, Patrick, thanks a lot for the call. Zach, let's take a break here. Back with Bob Berman in a moment at 800-348-2551.
Support comes from Boyden & Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts, and service to customers throughout western Massachusetts. A family-owned business for over 50 years, boydenandperrin.com. St. George's School, Clifton Park, New York, a private elementary school offering full-day academic programs to kindergarten and first-grade students, stgeorgeschoolcp.org. Washington County Tourism, announcing tour of the Battenkill, a 65-mile cycling race course, featuring an expo, art show, vendors, Main Street activities, and more. April 13th and 14th, WashingtonNYCounty.com. And Veterinary Emergency and Specialty Hospital, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, providing ophthalmology, surgery, and internal medicine services for dogs and cats, now offering laser eye surgery. VESHDeerfield.com.
All right, Bob Berman, what TV show is this incidental music for? Go ahead.
I give up.
Mannix. It's Lalo Schifrin. It's Vox Pop, 1-800-348-2551. He knows a lot about the stars, but very little about Mannix. We go to the phones again. Greg in Poughkeepsie. Greg.
Hi. Forgive me, this is a basic question, but scientists started talking about the sun and burning energy. And my question is, why doesn't the sun ever extinguish or lose its power, so to speak?
It will, right?
Sure. Well, because, the last caller actually mentioned that in 1920, Arthur Eddington finally answered the question why that doesn't happen, because we long knew that even if the sun were a lump of coal of the weight of the sun is 10 followed by 33 zeros of grams, or let's make it more sensible, 10 followed by 30 zeros tons.
Okay.
That's a huge weight. Grams, kilograms, So metric tons, it would have burned out in 2,000 years. A piece of coal the size of the sun would have burned itself out. So how can it possibly be giving us all this light and heat for billions of years? And that's when nuclear fusion was found to be the cause, simply for atoms of hydrogen merging to become a single atom of helium. And in the process, there is the emission of energy via E equals mc squared. The sun does lose 4 million tons of itself each second. Just said that, which makes you go, whoa, slow down. You don't have to do that. It seems like very scary.
Yeah.
But weighing 10 to the 30th tons, if you do the math, you realize that it will be 5 billion years, another 5 billion years before the sun loses even 10%. of its core mass. All the fusion happens within the inner 12% or so of the sun, and only then will strange things happen. Right now, it's actually in the process of getting brighter. It gets 10% more luminous every billion years, which is going to extinguish all life on Earth in only 1.1 billion years.
Yikes.
Unfortunately, I mean, we've had life on Earth for at least 3.9 billion years, so
yeah.
It's sad that we don't have another 4 billion years. We only have 1 billion years left before the sun snuffs out all the life on Earth, and yet it will continue to brighten, continue to be a normal G-type star, and it won't be until another 5 billion years that the next stage of its life happens due to the loss of the of its mass, and even then it'll only be a 10% loss.
But so what's the next phase? Is this the red giant?
Red giant collapsing to be a white dwarf. It'll puff out material, lose a lot of its outer material, and eventually some of these stars only become pure oxygen and carbon.
Okay.
Carbon and oxygen without any hydrogen or helium left, and star shrinks to the size of the Earth.
Okay.
Still weighing about what it does today, but the size of Earth. Mass of the sun, weight of the sun, size of the Earth. So then just every tablespoon of sun material would outweigh two cement trucks.
Wow.
And
that's
so
amazing.
Dense down. That's the ultimate fate. So for our caller, eventually, yeah, eventually it does. But we're okay for the next billion years.
All right, fair enough. Mark in Albany. Mark, you're on. Hello?
Or is that Mary?
Oh, it's Mary. Hi, Mary. Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. You're on.
I was wondering if you ever found any planets out there with moons going around that have their own moons.
Oh, good question.
Yeah, it's a great question. Not really. We found a little asteroid that has a little separate, smaller asteroid that could be called a moon. That's Gasper and Ida are their names.
Oh,
we have a planet that's practically only two moons rather than there being a planet, that is Pluto and Charon, two bodies that, you know, Pluto's, of course, been
right.
demoted, like all the other Disney characters. Pluto's become a dwarf, yet
okay.
another dwarf, like, okay, I'm not going to keep going with that
no,
analogy.
No, it's not.
But it's got, it's little, we used to say Pluto and its moon Charon, now we have a dwarf planet. That's really a double dwarf planet. So there are all sorts of odd configurations, but not a moon that has another moon.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Mary, thanks a lot. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman, our guest, 1-800-348-2551. By the way, where are you headed next? You're always going somewhere, whether it's Guam or Brazil. Or the moon. Where are you going now?
I just got back from Alaska. Well, our next trip... And now I'm like in one of those Greek tragicomedies, because somebody set up a company, it wasn't mine, called Berman Astronomy
Tours.
Oh,
boy.
And the next place that we're going, so I'm the lecturer on them, is Chile. And we're going to go in November to the Atacama Desert and to some of the mountaintops in Chile, where we've rented out a private observatory.
Nice.
Which has, I tell you, Ray, it's got the darkest skies I've ever seen. The Milky Way is so bright it casts shadows, literally.
Ooh,
casts
that's
shadows.
Interesting, yeah.
And the Magellanic Clouds, which are nearest galaxies, are so bright you almost have to put sunglasses on.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
That is
that's
ridiculous.
Hyperbole,
that
right?
was hyperbole.
Okay.
But the skies are just brilliant, and that's where we're going to go to see Comet Ison when it first appears.
Now, when does Ison come rolling along?
In November, and that's when we're going, in the middle of November when it first becomes naked eye. And the comet's almost an excuse to get under those dark skies and be in the Atacama Desert, which is just a fabulous desert, and see penguin colonies and things like that.
Mm.
So that's after a lot of traveling in the last bunch of months, New Zealand, Australia, and Peru, now nothing till November.
Very exciting. Back to the phones we go at 1-800-348-2551. Hey, it's Mo in Argyle. Mo, you're on.
Merle.
Oh, Merle.
Merle.
Does it not say M-O there, Bob?
It does.
I'm not out of my mind here.
It does.
Okay, all right.
It's Merle. I apologize, Merle. Go ahead.
All right. I just heard it on the radio within the last week about, I think it was carbon 14 or 15.
Carbon 14.
Year 744, 745. Did you write about it at all in the sun?
Well, I've written about carbon 14 because it's just a fascinating. Carbon 14 is a wonderful, wonderful thing.
I mean, did you hear anything about it just recently? About they were, I think it was the Japanese, and they were finding it all over our planet in different places. Carbon 14 and 15 in the
well,
744, and they were
oh a spike. In other words, a spike in,
yes.
in the background level or whatever
yes.
of carbon
right.
14.
Yes.
No, I haven't heard about
it. Well,
that.
It's fascinating. We should actually talk to our listeners about it because the normal carbon that we see around us is, we call it carbon 12 or just plain carbon because it's got six in the nucleus. If it's got six protons, six neutrons, so you add up the items or nucleons in the nucleus and you get 12. Six neutrons, six protons are 12, and that's what normal carbon is. But one in a million or so of the bits of carbon have been are not normal carbon 12, but have extra neutrons. They still have the same six protons because that's how you define what carbon
mm-hmm.
is. But they have two extra neutrons, and they really started out as nitrogen that got hit by cosmic rays and then converted into. Converted into carbon 14.
Is that the only way you can get carbon 14?
Yeah, that's the normal way that it's created. In other words, nitrogen has seven and seven of each, but if a cosmic ray knocks two of the protons off a bit of nitrogen, it will convert it into carbon, and yet it still has those two extra neutrons. So it is carbon, but it's carbon 14. Now, here's what's very cool about it. It's not stable, and half of every sample deteriorates in 5,728 years.
Okay.
And the reason this is nothing short of wonderful is that as we breathe in, or any life form breathes it in, including the plant cotton, breathes in, we expect to have a certain ratio in our bodies of regular carbon, carbon 12, and carbon 14.
Yeah.
Now, once we die, or any creature, any plant dies, obviously we no longer take in fresh carbon 14 mm-hmm. or carbon 12. Carbon 12 lasts forever. The carbon 14 slowly decays and disappears. And so in 5,728 years, half of that carbon 14 is gone. So if we examine something, use a mass spectrometer or a gas chromatograph or any method you want to see exactly.
I think they were using tree rings or something and the
yeah,
year was 744 and 745.
Excellent. So you use tree rings. You go, those are old, those are big trees. You go back and you see what the ratio was back then, and you can find out, A, how old the sample is by how much carbon 14 there is relative to carbon 12, but B, you can also tell what's going on in our atmosphere, because if there is an anomalously high amount of carbon 14 or low, that indicates
cosmic
that
rays.
That's right. The carbon rays
so
are weird at that time.
Our sun didn't or hasn't been pushing out any carbon 14 over time.
The sun doesn't send us any carbon 14. The sun sends us cosmic rays, and from the sun, they're both electrons and protons. Cosmic rays from space are, bewilderingly enough, almost entirely protons. 90% of them are protons. No one knows why, because in the universe, there are just as many electrons, and yet these high-speed broken bits of atoms that come from space are almost entirely protons. No one knows why. They come from supernova explosions. They come from elsewhere, but when they hit molecules of our air, that's what produces the carbon 14.
So
the amount of it that's then taken in by plants like your tree rings or in cotton clothing by mummies, you know, that we find
right.
buried with cotton clothing, you know, that had their brains sucked out, however we they did
yeah,
the mummies.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. Yeah, that's great.
And then we know exactly how old they were by comparing the carbon 14.
Well, Mo, thanks a lot for the call. So what could have then in 744 or 745, what could have been a possible cause of increased cosmic radiation?
We could have had greater or lesser activity from the sun. The sun does an interesting thing. Although it produces more broken bits of atoms toward us, more importantly, it acts as a shield. So when the sun is most active during sunspot maximum, like this year,
mm-hmm.
it produces a protective bubble around the solar system that blocks incoming cosmic rays.
Right.
And so it protects us from interstellar cosmic rays, which are actually the faster and more dangerous ones. So paradoxically, when the solar flux of radiation gets stronger, the flux from outside of the solar system gets weaker. And the two go hand in hand. So at times, for example, in 2005, 2006, when the sun was historically very quiet, quieter than anyone alive has ever seen it, that's just when we got the greatest influx of interstellar cosmic rays coming in. So this extra production of carbon-14 during this period in the 700s told us that something weird was happening from the sun, or there could have been a supernova that went off in our galaxy.
Would have been visible, though, right? There would have been some accounts
maybe
of that
not,
written
because
down?
It could have been hidden behind the dusty dust clouds that are here and there in the galaxy and could have been hidden from our sight.
Mm.
And we could have just been receiving that on Earth at that time.
So there's really no theory as to why it's mainly protons?
No, it's one of the remaining mysteries of cosmic rays, why these things should be 90% protons. It doesn't make sense, really.
Well, let's go to Mike in Loudonville. Mike, you're on.
Hi, my question is, we know the Big Bang and the universe started with the Big Bang, but can we actually point into the three-dimensional sky and say that's where the Big Bang occurred, right out in that direction right there?
Yep. Easy to do. It's a common question. And when we look and see where the Big Bang occurred, it was obvious that it happened in Saugerties.
Oh, cut it out.
Saugerties, New York, or wherever you happen to live. I'm not joking, because everything in the universe is rushing away from your position on Earth. We live in a cluster of galaxies called, unimaginatively, the local group. Mm-hmm. And all other clusters of galaxies are racing away from us. For every million light years farther, they're racing away 14 miles a second faster. And because this is so uniform throughout the universe, we know that everything is racing away from this point. Therefore, we can trace the paths backward of everything else. The farthest galaxies are moving faster directly away from us. The nearest galaxies are moving quite slowly. As I said, at a distance of 10 million light years, they're only going 140 miles a second. So you trace everything back and you see everything was right here 13.8 billion years ago. And so here had to have been the location of the Big Bang. Now, it's also a fact that no matter where you're located in the universe, you'd see the same thing. You'd see that the universe is racing away from you wherever you are. So how do you make sense of that? It's actually quite easy. And the usual analogy, which I did not invent, but I can't improve on it, so I use it, is that of a balloon that's just slightly inflated and it has polka dots painted on it, and pretend you're living on any one of the polka dots. As the balloon is inflated, the other polka dots nearest to you move away slowly. The polka dots farthest from you move away faster. And as the balloon gets bigger and bigger, everything keeps moving away from you, regardless of where you were. So if you take that same analogy, and instead of it being the curved two-dimensional surface of a balloon, imagine three-dimensional space, then you have the true picture of the Big Bang. And the short answer to the question, it's not being a smart aleck. Where was the Big Bang? It was right here. Everybody can say it was right here, no matter where they live. Because there was only one H-E-R-E at that time. There was only one here. So we were all taking a bit of it with us at that time. And then one more asterisk to that is that the Big Bang was only the creation of the observable or visible universe. There's more and more evidence. I talked about that last time, as you know, Ray, that the universe is actually infinite, and you can't get infinity from a finite beginning. So the Big Bang could only have been an event in the hood, a local event.
Mm.
And the universe beyond is maybe composed of independent Big Bangs, whatever it is. We don't have any information about it. But the Big Bang was the observable universe, not the actual universe.
All right, Mike, does that make sense?
Not at all.
Would you like to do a follow-up?
I don't even know a follow-up question to ask because, you know, it started out at some point, but you're saying the point really is kind of everywhere.
Yes. Now, I'll show you why you can't think of it any other way. Now, if you want there to be a point that you could look at and say, there's the point, you would have had to be outside that place to see it as a point. Now, the universe, you can't be outside the universe. Nobody can be outside the universe by definition. So you can never be on the outside looking at a point that then is seen in a particular direction. You're always within the universe, aren't you? And if you're always within the universe, this is what we see. Everybody can visualize it, that all galaxies are rushing away from your position, all clusters of galaxies. That's not difficult to visualize. If instead what you're trying to do is visualize the whole universe as if it were a balloon that you're seeing from the outside, you're trying to set up a non-existent vantage point, a vantage point that never existed and never can exist because no eyes can be outside the universe to look at that inflating structure. It doesn't exist. There is no such viewpoint. And it's when trying to create that that produces all the problems of visualization.
Okay. And yeah, all right. So we hear the crickets going. Mike, anything more?
I got nothing. Let me think about that one. But I appreciate it. I really have been wondering the answer to that question for a long time, and that's the first answer I've ever got.
Well, it was an unsatisfactory answer, frankly. But I don't think these astronomers know much. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. We're going to take a break here. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. The more we know, the less we know, and I think Bob would agree to that. We'll be back with more coming up.
Support comes from Bethel Woods Center for the Arts, presenting Sundays with Friends with Jennifer Coe, violin, and Benjamin Hockman, piano, Sunday, April 7th, bethelwoodscenter.org. The Albany Academies, Albany, New York, hosting the Albany Children's Book Festival April 27th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., featuring 50 authors and illustrators, open to the public. AlbanyChildren'sBookFestival.org. Vision Excel Eye Care, Lake Katrine, New York, providing eye exams, eye care, dry eye therapy, and more, where eyewear is an art. Facebook or VisionExcelEyeCare.com. And the Honest Wade Food Co-op in Albany, offering local and organic produce, natural groceries, artisan cheeses, and more. HonestWait.coop.
Mike is probably pondering the last answer, as I am. It's Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. Astronomer Bob Berman is our guest, and we always welcome your calls. Let's go to Vane in Beacon. You're on.
Hi. You were talking about the gamma rays being sourced from protons, or being protons.
And cosmic rays?
I'm sorry, cosmic rays. Yeah, gamma rays would be radio waves. Anyway, is there any thought given to what's left behind might be the neutrons, which would be dark matter? And what do people think about that?
What do you think, Bob?
You know, that's not a bad idea of neutrons being dark matter, but there's reasons why it can't be, and that is that neutrons are still baryonic, bits of baryonic material. And if
what does baryonic mean?
It means baryons, for example, made of quarks. Neutrons are made of quarks, and protons are made of quarks.
Oh, quarks. I thought you said corks. Okay, all right, go on.
And there are several theoretical reasons why dark matter, as we try to cross them off the list, of course, using Occam's razor, we want the simplest explanations if we could possibly find them. We have six times more dark matter than visible matter. The only thing we know for sure about dark matter is it exerts a gravitational pull. It makes our galaxy rotate in a different way than if it didn't exist. It glues the other galaxies in our group together. Without dark matter, the local group of galaxies would have flown apart long ago. So, and we see this in other clusters of galaxies, too. So everywhere we look, there's six times more dark matter than regular matter. So what is it? If it were any of the materials that we've slowly crossed off the list, including neutrons, it would either block things behind it, or it would cause local clumping. It would do things that we don't see.
Yeah.
So the best idea, and it's far from set in stone, is that this is a new type, new for us anyway, new type of material, perhaps analogous to neutrinos that pass through other objects, because so far as we know, dark matter is right here in the room with us, passing through us. Maybe there were dark matter structures, dark matter people.
Oh, interesting.
And
thanks for that. Now I'll have something else to think about.
And they don't interact. Just like neutrinos, there's a trillion neutrinos passing through each of our fingernails every second. Every second. And of course, they don't have any particular fondness for fingernails. I mean, every fingernail part of our body, size of our body, a trillion neutrinos doesn't harm us, goes through the whole Earth. And so dark matter would presumably be the same kind of thing, not interactive with what we have. And so far as we know, since it does have gravity, it can form structure. And there's another universe out there, a dark matter universe, of which we are not a part. And we're definitely the minority. The baryonic matter is a smaller fraction of the stuff that has gravity in the universe. The dark matter, whatever it is the bulk of it.
So you're saying the dark matter can form objects, for the lack of a better term?
Maybe.
That could be here. In other words, a completely parallel universe.
Yes, considering that they have gravity, that they exert gravity on each other and on existing
matter. But not on us?
On us, too. But with small clumps, we don't exert much gravity. Like, we're here in the room together.
Right.
We're not glomming together, thank goodness.
Yeah.
So there's not, gravity isn't a dominant force until you get to big masses of it. So if there was small dark matter objects, let's say people-sized dark matter objects, they could be passing through us and we wouldn't detect it.
Wow. But a dark matter planet, we would be able to detect.
Yeah. But yet, you know, there's six times more. It's in the galaxy. It forms a halo around the galaxy. It pervades the galaxy. So where does it end? We're not close to answering these yet.
Vane, thanks a lot for the call. This is all too far out, man. Let's go to Lou in Voorheesville. Lou.
Why do we not feel ourselves moving through space?
Aha.
Well, simply everything else is moving as well. You know, we only feel changes in motion, accelerations. Like, for example, once you're in a train and the train is moving along at a regular clip, or you're in a plane, if it's smooth air, you can't tell you're moving, even though you're going 500 miles an hour through the air, because everything else is moving and it's not slowing down or speeding up. So we only feel changes. So here we are on Earth. Everything around us, all the trees, all the birds, the clouds, the atmosphere is all moving with us. Forget about moving through space. We can't even tell that we're spinning, even though we're spinning almost 800 miles an hour here in, a little slower than that here. Actually, you spin at the speed of sound, 700 and something miles an hour, depending on air temperature and pressure in Woodstock. I always found it odd that, you know, the spin of Earth, which is 1,038 miles an hour at the equator and falls to zero at the poles, where is it exactly at the speed of sound that you move?
Yeah.
Woodstock.
Of course.
With all the music and the stuff there.
Sure.
So we don't even feel that we're moving as a spin, let alone moving through space, just because everything else is moving, A, and B, there's no change in our speed. And that's what you'd have to feel in order to feel motion.
If I was able to instantly teleport from the pole to the equator, would I feel a momentary rush?
Momentary, sure. In fact, that's what the Coriolis effect is. If you shoot a cannonball or hit a baseball or anything, and you move it towards the north or to the south, let's just stick with north for the moment. Let's say you're in Florida, where the Earth turns at a slower speed, and you aim it moves at a faster speed than here, and you aim a cannonball toward the north. As the cannonball flies north, it's also going over ground that's moving slower and slower.
Yeah.
So the cannonball, which had an initial motion to the right or to the east, is going to seem to curve. Anybody on the ground sees it curving, and so there is a visible consequence of moving from one place to another, not to mention you'd lose a pound of weight.
Well, I could use that. You know, it seems to me that then those who would aim ballistic missiles have to take this into account.
And they do.
Very interesting. Bob Berman is our guest. Now, we're on a completely different topic that we have never been on this topic before.
Yeah.
Let's go to Ed in Pittsfield. Ed.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around the question about Mike's question about the origin of the Big Bang, if we could point to this point where it came from. Now, I would think that if the Big Bang, it would be like a firecracker exploding, and everything moved out from one central point. Am I correct in assuming that?
Yes, except it wasn't actual motion of objects, but rather the expansion of space between the energies which eventually became the material. There were no actual material objects, but once they formed, it was actually space itself expanding. But yes, let's go on, but with that
I'm just going on the thought that everything is moving out from that one central point.
Right. Right.
And am I correct to assume that?
Yes,
so
yes.
Why can't we point to that? I'm going back to the example of the balloon. If you're a polka dot on a balloon, everything expands at different rates away from the one polka dot, but it had to start in the middle, correct?
Okay, if you were on that balloon, now if you're outside of the balloon, sure, you can point to that balloon and say, there's the balloon that started out as a spot, and there it is expanding, and you could point in one direction to find the balloon. But you'd have to be outside the balloon to do that. And you can never be outside the universe by definition. Everything is within the universe. So now place yourself. No, so place yourself from the beginning. Place yourself on the tiny balloon made up of innumerable particles. You're on the surface of the balloon from the start. And the balloon gets bigger and bigger. No matter where you're standing on the balloon, all the other particles are going to be expanding away from your spot. And they'll be in all directions. There won't be one direction you'd point to say, here it is. You could point in any direction.
Outward from the center.
Yes, that's because this analogy is using a two-dimensional curved surface, which is that of the balloon. But if instead you had a three-dimensional surface, which is the actual universe, then there is no center to the balloon to point to. Then it's just simply everywhere. And as we look now, as we stand within the expanding universe, it is absolutely equally in all directions. The point of origin is absolutely equally H-E-R-E for anybody. And there's no getting around it. And I don't even find this difficult to visualize as long as you confine yourself to being within the universe. What I find is that when people have difficulty with this, again, the difficulty is that they try to picture themselves outside the universe, which presumably not even God has that advantage. You can't be outside the universe looking into the universe.
I can picture myself, everything expanding in every direction. We're using your balloon example, but still that would leave a void in the middle, wouldn't it?
Yes, but only because the balloon analogy is only an analogy. The surface of a balloon is a two-dimensional surface, curved surface.
Right.
Actual space is three dimensions and four if you consider time. So if you add those into it, then there is no middle to point to. The middle of the balloon, you only have that because we're not using a true analogy, but only a two-dimensional analogy. Pretend that the surface of the balloon was all there was, and you were a two-dimensional creature living on that surface. And there were no third dimension. Then there'd be no center to point toward. So that problem goes away.
Scratching my head on this.
Yeah, absolutely. thanks a lot for the call. So, what is space, Bob?
That's a great question. And there's some thoughts now that there's really no such thing as space. Certainly, we already know there's no such thing as time, except as a way that animals make sense of changes. Time and space aren't things that you can bring to a lab and analyze like cottage cheese, let's say. And there are at least six different reasons to believe that space is not a real commodity, but only something that we use to make sense of things. First of all, space means emptiness, right?
Right.
Okay. There is no emptiness because there is increasing evidence ever since 1949 of the Casimir effect that all of space is permeated by an unimaginably powerful energy field. And there's several separate bits of evidence for this. And since energy and mass are equivalent, you don't have emptiness. And this is in addition to the 2.73 degree heat left over from the Big Bang,
Kelvin,
right, that permeates all of space. And since this energy is also equivalent to mass, there is no part of space that's empty. So you can't have emptiness that way. Secondly, what we define as space is often done via language. For example, we'll use colors or shapes or other methods to make sense of where one object ends and another one begins. Mm-hmm. We do this everywhere. Sometimes we run into problems. For example, where is the edge of a waterfall? Do you count the? Do you include the outer bits of spray? Do you include the places between the bubbles, the raindrops? Is that in the waterfall or outside of it? So a lot of these are arbitrary. And then third, Einstein has told us that the actual dimensions of space change. How large they are depending upon your perspective, how fast you're traveling, how strong the gravity is, changes the actual dimensions of space. And nothing that can change according to your perspective can be an actual real object.
Okay.
And I could go on and
all
on.
All right. Well, so you said that in the Big Bang, space itself expanded from nothing. Okay. Now, presumably, all that is space is our universe, which you now say is infinite. So, therefore, how can it have expanded from nothing in a Big Bang if it is, in fact, infinite?
The only way we can get to that, and we're not sure the universe is infinite, but more and more evidence, especially since early last year, the Berkeley team who showed us that the topology of space, that is, the way space-time fails to curve, it's straight to the farthest reaches of what we can see, showing us that the universe, at minimum, goes on far beyond the visible universe.
But that's not the same.
No, because you can never prove infinity. You can prove a finite universe. You can't prove infinity. However, the cosmologists, all the great Rocky Kolb, all the great cosmologists that are around that I've interviewed for an article I wrote about this some months ago, all believe that the evidence is strongly pointing to an infinite universe. So it takes us.
I don't know how you reconcile that with the Big Bang.
Okay, and that's what I'm about to do. If the Big Bang started at a certain point, and of course we have no idea what could have produced the Big Bang, but if the Big Bang started from a finite point, how do you get to an infinite universe from there? You cannot. And that means, or at least that indicates, that the Big Bang was an object, a local object, a local phenomenon in our neighborhood, in the visible or observable universe, and that beyond it, there are perhaps a trillion other Big Bangs that have gone on in different stages.
Well, then you could see it, though.
No, you can't see.
If you're on another universe, you could potentially see this one expanding, yes? I mean, if it's one of many, if there are many houses, then would we not be able to, from the proper vantage point, see the expansion?
From the proper vantage point, but that we don't have that vantage
point. All right, well, let's go back to the phones. My head is spinning. Ken in Durham. Ken, you're on.
Yeah, speaking of cottage cheese, I'm telling you. I began this day with X number of unanswered questions in my life, and now I have X plus Y. How do you cope personally with the knowledge that you will die before you really know what's going on? I can tell you that it bothers me. It's my one gripe about life. Like, I don't mind dying, but I'm very esteemed that I will not have any of these questions lucidly answered for me.
Certainly not on this program.
How do you, as Mr. Berman, as a professional, does it bother you that you will?
No, it doesn't. And that's a personal question that I probably shouldn't answer because I don't get into. You're not supposed to get into personal answers, but let's just say there may be other ways of perceiving. Other than the logical, scientific, intellectual, and that questions that always give puzzling or wrong or paradoxical answers, there's probably something wrong with the question. And it could be that the brain logic, intellectual, dualistic, symbolic language system is inadequate for questions about the universe as a whole, and that perhaps there are other levels of seeing or experiencing that reveal what's really going on with the universe as a whole. And perhaps some people have experienced this through the ages and then are quite satisfied with what's going on.
Yeah, so being is knowing, my friend.
This is so unsatisfying to him. I'm sorry. I apologize for the answer, but you asked me.
I know. I didn't expect a satisfying answer, but I appreciate your effort. Thank you.
Ken, thanks a lot. And that's a perfect unsatisfying way to end the program. Thanks to everybody who called in, and I'm sorry if we didn't get through. Try earlier next time is my best advice. And Bob is back every month, and we will do this thing again. Wow. Interesting program today, Bob.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I know I frustrated some people.
No. It was intellectually stimulating, right? Time for my nap. Support comes from HMT at the Spa Little Theater, presenting Ken Ludwig's Leading Ladies Weekends, April 19th through May 5th in the Saratoga Spa State Park, homemadetheater.org. Four Seasons Natural Food Store and Cafe, Saratoga Springs, New York. Locally owned and operated since 1988. Open 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. 7 days a week. FourSeasonsNaturalFoods.com. We Are Waka, Lake George, New York, an enrichment and revitalization historic lakefront retreat created by and for women since 1903. WIAWAKA.org for events. And Foresight Land Services, Pittsfield, Massachusetts, for 45 years offering civil engineering, land surveying, land planning, and environmental permitting to private and municipal clients in the Berkshires and Eastern New York, foresightland.com. Thanks again for joining us today. Interesting program with Mr. Berman. He'll be back next month. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who handled the controls. Matt Don Diego answered the phones. Tom Jobe assisted with our website and social media. Our producer, the exalted one, Patrick Dungis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow in this hour, Moyers and Company on Medical Monday next week at 2, Dr. Ron Stram. Stay tuned now for a news update.